Good afternoon. So today I'm going to do exam review. So what would you like me to talk about? Yes. The quiz questions on what, sorry? On number of misses in the last post quiz. Okay, it's also a hand over here, yeah. Q7, can you tell me what the general area they're on? Kind of question?
So with an initial empty 16 points right now, cash.
So cash miscounting?
Yes.
Okay. Other things people would like me to talk about? Yes.
Question 13, spring 2018 exam 2.
Which is about
address mapping to same set.
Addresses mapping to same set. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Latency versus throughput, sequential versus pipeline.
Throughput. Anything more specific?
Like calculating.
Okay. Calculating. Let's see. Okay, other. Yeah. Sorry?
Red hazard, colluding hazard.
Okay. Which is on. Okay, hazards in a. Four-stage pipeline, okay. Yeah.
The right strategies for
cash, like okay. Anything else? That's all, yeah.
Fall of 2017, question 9.
Which is on?
It's like a cache.
Okay. I would suggest that I probably don't need to go over 5 different of those questions. Though I could.
Fall of 2017.
2017, right, yes. It wouldn't make sense for it to be a sneak preview of the exam. So other topics, anything else? Okay, so apparently we're not reviewing cache blocking, which surprises me, but okay. Okay. Okay, so function inlining. Okay. Other topics? Okay, so latency and throughput. So latency is time from start to finish for some operation. Throughput is the rate at which operations complete, usually, so usually we write this as operations per time unit, time. Can also write it as time per operation completed, but still throughput, not latency. So the difference between latency is like if we're finishing, if we start something, work state has 3 steps and we finish it, and we can do 2 things at once here. Dot. Here we have a throughput of 1 operation per time unit. where this is presumably each step is a time unit. This is time going this way. And a latency of 5 time units per operation, you know, equals one time unit per operation completed. Here, S start operation E equals end operation. So that's latency versus throughput. So as for calculating them for processors, for our single cycle processor, we do one instruction at a time. So latency, so time per instruction equals time between when instructions complete. So the rate at which we complete instructions in the single cycle processor is determined entirely based on how long each instruction takes. Since we don't start the next instruction until we completely do the current one. And the time per instruction is for all these cases, or time per, you know, per circuit is the critical path. So the longest sequence of operations that needs to complete in a clock cycle. And this applies for both our single cycle and our pipeline. In the single cycle, this is operations from, you know, getting the new PC at the beginning of the cycle all the way to writing all the instructions values. For our pipeline processor, this is operations between each set of pipeline, for each pipeline stage, which is typically, you know, typically between two pipeline registers. Exception, the ends are up to the first pipeline register from the last pipeline register. But the timer is based on the longest path. The idea is set cycle time equals critical path length. So a thing about critical paths, so the subtle critical paths are that not everything is on the critical path. So with single cycle, operations which can be done in parallel. For example, adding a X to the PC while reading registers. Like those two things can be done in parallel, so the critical path's only going to include one of them. And probably it's reading registers because there's a lot of stuff to do after that. With the pipeline, this means that only the longest stage matters is the most important part of that. Also, if there are multiple ways of going through a stage, only the longest one matters. So for example, you know, in our end, so in our memory stage, we send some values from the execute stage without changing them, or we read memory. The thing which matters is that we read memory because we can send the values through. That's no work for free in parallel. So as for calculating the time, sum of things on critical path, but remember that pipeline registers take time. We mentioned that registers take a certain amount of time to work. You need to include that time if there are pipeline registers. Yeah?
What should I include the delay in
the
pipeline processor?
So this is the sometimes called the register delay or the pipeline register delay, that's the time, when we ask that, say that in questions, it's the time the pipeline registers take. So other questions? Latency, throughput, computing for single versus cycle versus not. Okay, so next we have questions on the RET and load use hazards. So for RET, and I'll do here, I'm assuming this is in the five stage processor we used. So there we do a RET. We go through fetch, decode, execute, memory, write back, and we need to take the value from memory and use it to fetch the next instruction. And that means that before we finish the memory stage, you know, we can't fetch yet. So the result is three cycles of stalling when we do that. And we might have more stalling or less stalling if we change the number of pipeline stages before we get to the memory stage. But the key thing is that we need to wait until the memory stage is almost done before we know what to fetch. Fetch yet. In our load use hazard, we have something like a pop, or I'll give a more straightforward, so MR move Q into, say, R9, does W, and then, like, say, an add Q using R9. So the add Q is going to need the value from the memory stage before it can do its execute work. And to align that up, we end up seeing that we have an extra cycle we need. So this is a cycle of waiting even with forwarding. In order to make the execute stage happen at the right time, I'm not guaranteeing, in practice, like we might do fetch and decode twice, so like stall decode, but the same result's the same. We need to get that execute stage after the memory so the value can be sent, because when we're here, we just don't have, you know, value isn't ready before that. So questions on those? So the result is one cycle of waiting even with forwarding, which we need to stall for, and this is any time we read a value from memory and want to use it in execute. We get this situation when things line up that way in our five-stage pipeline. So questions on these? Yeah. So the question is, forwarding is moving anything from memory to execute? No! Forwarding is moving anything between anything, but anything that wouldn't happen through the normal mechanism of using like the registers or so on. So in fact, we have a case here at the top where we're sending a value from memory to fetch. That's arguably forwarding. We aren't picky about the definition, but here when we're forwarding, you know, we're forwarding from memory to execute, but tip memory to execute really in your implementation, this probably ended up being, you know, probably forwarding from memory to end of decode, from end of memory to end of decode, versus you know, no hazard here. Then here, we're going to forward just as an example from the code from the end of execute to end of decode, and if we do the same thing with, I won't draw out the picture, R8, R9, NOP, sub-Q, R9, R10, we have end of memory to end of decode. Okay, so other questions? Yeah.
I was turning, like, for quiz 9, there was a question about, like, how to determine, like, whether or not you cache misses.
We'll get there. This is on the list. If it's cache misses. Unless it's that this is a question about stalling or forwarding here. Yes?
Is this end of the code this? End of the code executes?
So, oh, yeah. So for hazards in another pipeline, so we have, I don't remember what the pipeline is, the general rule is draw out, you know, general idea is draw, well, I'll pull up the question, but the general idea is you draw out pictures like what I've seen there, shown there. Website file, this is Spring 2018, Exam 2, let's take out the key version so I don't embarrass myself so much, and question 5. So this processor here is fetch and decode, execute 1, execute 2, and memory and write back. And we're asked about the snippet MR move Q into R11, add Q R11 R8, sub Q R8 R11, and pop Q R8. So I'm going to write the timeline for this. So we have fetch, decode, execute, memory, write back. Then we have add Q of R11, which needs R11 from MR move Q. Or sorry, I wrote this wrong because I wasn't paying attention to the question. To do MW. Okay, so there's, yeah.
Actually, for this question, it's like the 5-stage pipeline. Question 4 is the 4-stage, question 5 is the
5-stage. And you want the 5-stage?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so we can do the 5-stage too. In a 5-stage pipeline. So fetch, decode, write back here. We need R11. R11 is not going to be available until the memory stage, so we have to execute after that memory stage because we can't use R11 in our addition until after the memory stage reads it. Then I'm just going to align everything else to make that happen, and we have, did I not do that right? Why am I? Oh, right. Yeah. So we have one cycle of stalling, which makes sense. And here we need R8, add queue and need R11 from MR move queue. We have to start after the add queue. So we're going to start at minimum here. And we need to wait to execute until after add queue executes in order to be able to forward the value. We don't have to do any extra work to do that. We're going to start in the natural place. Here, we need RSP, which, you know, is already there. And that's it, because we're writing to R8. We don't care about its old value. So this executes without waiting. That makes sense? Okay. So then we have Spring 2018 question 13, which asks about where we have a cache, which is 4-way, 16 kilobyte, 16 byte blocks. Cache, 16 byte blocks, and we have 16 bit addresses, and we mentioned a replacement and write back policy. So, question is, which map to the same set as OX1234? So we need to figure out how do we split up OX1234 into tag, index, and offset. So tag, index, offset. So first, how many tag, index, and offset bits are there? So remember that offset is location within block. We have 16 locations, which means we need 4 bits because 2 to the 4 equals 16. Our set index, we often write index, it's the set index, is the number of the set. So the question is, we have how many sets? Well, let's figure that out. So we have a 16 kilobyte cache with 16 byte blocks, which means we have 1K blocks in total. We have 4 blocks per set, which means that we have 1K divided by 4, 1K blocks divided by 4 blocks per set, which is going to be 1K over 4 sets, which gives us 256 sets. And 256 sets, we're going to need 8 bits, because 2 to the 8 is 256. And the tag is everything else, in this case, 16-bit addresses minus 8 minus 4 equals 4 bits. So OX1234, our tag is OX1, our index is OX23, and our offset is OX4. And it's asking which would map to the same set. The only thing we care about for the set is the index. So it's asking which have the same index. Conveniently, since everything's a multiple of 4 here, we can just look at the middle digits of the hex numbers, and we find out that the answer is the OX1235. And OX F23F have the same, same set versus not same set. We have OX1A34 and OX1004. And if it didn't happen to align with nibbles, wasn't multiple of 4 for the set index and offset bits, you'd have to like split it up into binary and find out where the bits are. Okay, questions? Yeah.
Can you quickly explain how you got 16-bit addresses?
How do I get 16-bit addresses? Because the question said that at the top. Otherwise, I would have no way of knowing. So next is direct map versus set associative. So direct mapped is exactly equal to one-way set associative. Exactly the same thing. We usually just don't say one-way set associative. I'm guessing that's not what the person who asked this was looking for. So, you know, n-way set associative means n places to put each block means can store n different things with the same index bits. So direct map is the case where n is 1. So, you know, we only have one thing with each particular set of index bits. Questions? Yeah. So fully associative, yeah. So fully associative, in the same way, you can think of it as equal to number of blocks in cache way set associative. So other questions? Yeah.
Draw that.
Can I redraw that? Sure. So our direct map cache, we have our, I probably should use a not giant pen. We'll take it down to. So in a, now I need to find, I really lose my, there we go. Oh, I just made it invisible, okay, that's why. So a direct map cache, we have our cache. So we have our sets, we have a tag, we have a valid bit, tag, we have the actual data, and we might have some other data like maybe like a dirty bit, and this is a one-way equals direct mapped. If we have, say, a three-way cache, we have three copies of this. So we have our valid bit and a tag, and the data, and some any other data we need, and we have that duplicated three times. And in either case, we go to a particular row number equals index bits. And the same thing is going to be true here. And the row, I'll probably use a different color, and the row includes all the way across all these three ways. Number equals index bits. And in a fully associative, associative equals number of blocks way. We have just one row for everything, like always the one row. So there are no index bits because there's only one place to go. So 2 to the 0 is 1. One, and each of these slots is going to still have a valid bit and a tag and any other extra metadata. That what you were looking for? Apologies that I draw quick. My quick drawings are possibly unreadable. Yeah. Next to the row here. So row number equals index bits value. Value for all versions. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yes. We'll do that in a second round of questions. Possibly after catch blocking. Yes. So the question is, in the three-way associative, how do I know which of the three choices I have? So we have, so we have our tags. So we're going to look at the tags across each of the three ways. So tags, if matches the address we're reading, address equals use this. If none match, that means a miss. Yeah.
On the subject of misses, in 2015, question 12, the question is, conflict misses are discussed in connection with, and then it asks the type of cache. And the answer is direct mapped. Why is it not also set associative?
That is a bad question. That is why. Yes. So the question is, what's least recently used mean? Least used is accessed in any way. So reading counts and writing counts. Okay. So I'll go back to my text document and I'll add locality T spatial temporal to the bottom of this list, and we'll keep going on here. Okay, so write strategies for each of these. Write strategies. So write allocate is when the program writes, do I make a new cache? Do I bring something into the cache because of this? So the pro is hopefully the program will read it, read that value or near it, in which case bringing something in is a win. The con is it means that writes now become reads plus writes, because we have to read the value to bring it into the, read the things around the thing that was being written, read the rest of the block in order to do a write. And that's going to be disadvantageous if the program usually doesn't read from around where we're writing, well, where it's writing. So write no allocate is the opposite of this, is when the program writes, modify value if I have it. Otherwise, just send it to memory. Otherwise, send it to memory without any extra work. So we also independently talked about write back versus write through. Write through is when the program writes. Don't send it to memory until I need to. Write through is when the program writes. Always send it to memory immediately. So a thing that confuses people is how does write allocate and write back, write through interact? They are independent choices. So if I have a write through, write allocate cache, I'm saying that when you write, I'm always going to send it to memory, and also I'm going to read in that block into my cache. If I have a write back, write no allocate cache, I'm saying that if I'm caching it, I'm going to not write it back until I'm done, but I'm not going to start caching it just because you wrote to it. So these are independent choices, though typically write through caches are going to be write no allocate, and write back caches are going to be write allocate, because that does make more sense, but they are actually independent choices. You can do any combination. Yes? So the question is, which is more commonly used? It's typically tied to the choice of write back versus write through, which is generally considered more important. And whether you use write back or write through typically depends what level of the cache hierarchy you're at. And is probably mostly determined by concerns we haven't discussed dealing with multiple processors. Yes. So write back typically, but not always with write allocate. Other questions on write strategies? Yeah. Write no allocate's pros and cons are basically the opposite here. Like that the con is you're not taking advantage of the program reads values near it, you're gonna do worse. And the pro is that, you know, writes are just writes. They don't do extra reads with that you might not care about. So then about counting cache misses. So first I'm going to do high-level strategy for cache miss counting. Values that map to the same set. So first is figure out how big blocks are in terms of what's being accessed. So, you know, what values map to the same block? And figure out what values map to the same set. And the general rule is, if you know the number of bytes in array, which is why it was in that cache lab, then values separated by, you know, so find number of bytes in array, values separated by k times the number of bytes in a way map to the same set. Because we wrap around when we think of our cache, so way of drawing that is that if we have even an associative cache, so we have our two sets here, that if we're at index, if this is 0, then this is 0 plus, you know, x down here. Then we have like 0 plus 2x. And then we eventually like wrap around to like 0 plus 3x. And so the question is, so we have this sort of wraparound where plus x equals go down, you know, x over block size sets, but wraparound. So that means that so we can use that rule there to figure out when we're going to have things mapping to the same set. And you can analyze each set independently. So if you just know this axis, these axes all go to the same set, you can try to just say what's going to happen to this set alone, because it doesn't matter what happens to the other sets in between, because there's no way accessing a block that goes to another set can evict something from that set, from the original set. So with that in mind, let's pull up the quiz question. Quizzes, which was 13, 14, yes. So we'll take the hard one, which is So we'll start with, so here, and we have a 16 byte blocks, so that means 4 ints per block. And it is a direct map 248 byte cache. So this means that, note that A0 and A512 are 512 times 4 equals 2048 bytes apart. So A0 and A512 map to the same set. Also, because we have 4 ints per block, this means A0 and A1 and A2 and A3 are in the same block, assuming blocks start at A0, which the question says they do, by telling us that the address of A0 is a multiple of some power of 2. So let's think about what happens to just the cache set that contains A0. So, you know, we can extend this logic and say also A1024 maps to the same set, and A1024 plus 512 maps to that set. So there are 4 values we're accessing which all map to the same set, and the question we want to answer is it the case that we're gonna evict things from the cache? And an observation you can make is that, you know, if I equals 0, J equals 0, we're accessing A of 0. Here, if I equals, let me do division with a calculator because I don't like making mistakes in front of the class. I equals 16, J equals 0, we have A512. If 16? Oh, right. Oh, I just said some values that we don't care about. I mentioned these values, but they aren't actually in the question because the array is only 1024 long. Okay. So I equals 0 and I equals 16, J equals 0 both access it. So a question we might have is these are in the same block. So what other accesses do we have to that block? And so when I equals 0, J equals 1, we access A1. And we can do the same reasoning for what's in the same block as A512. So A512, A513, and A514, and A515 are in the same block. By the same reasoning, we said A0, 1, 2, and 3 are in the same block. And I'm just going to say these same block, and these are all the things that are in this set of the cache. So I'm just recording when in this loop do we access that set. So 16J equals 1 is A513. And we have the same thing and similar for J equals 2, J equals 3. So an observation you can make here is that A equals 1 is always a miss because we accessed A512 in between A0 and A1. Does that make sense? So A0 and A1, they're in the same block. That's an opportunity to have the cache take advantage of locality. But we access this A512, which is interfering in between. And if we do the same analysis for A513, this is, again, always a miss because we accessed A1 in between A512 and A513. So it doesn't help us that A512 and A513 are part of the same cache block. We still lose. And if we repeat this analysis for A4, which is in the second set, and A5-12 plus 4, we'll get the same answer. We get the same answer for every single part block of A, every single cache block that the array A contains. We can do the same analysis, we just have slightly different eyes, but we always find we access another part block that maps to the same set in between two accesses to the same block. So every single access is a miss. Even though if you count the number of blocks we're accessing, it looks like we are accessing blocks repeatedly, we should have an opportunity for cache hits. That's not the case here. Yes?
Because this cache is direct mapped,
right? So this cache is direct mapped, so that's why the analysis works out this way. It turns out that if the cache were not direct mapped, so if the cache were fully associative, we wouldn't have this problem. But if the cache were two-way set associative, we might, that doesn't necessarily fix this problem. Because we still have two sets. So we have twice as much per set, but now with a two-way, suppose two-way set associative, now A0 and A256 and A512 and A768 all map to the same set, and we'd have the same problem. Even though we had two slots, and between accessing A0 and A1, we'd access A256 and A512, probably evicting A0, assuming LRU like. Yeah?
The problem is we're overwriting
So the problem is, that we're accessing some blocks in a way which looks like we should have locality, but because of the way our sets work out, we're overwriting that block in particular, even though we're not using the whole cache, really. And this is the kind of problem you'll see frequently when you have powers of two indices, which is really the big thing which is going on here. Yes?
That would change if you flipped the order of the loops, though, right?
So the question is, would changing the loop order make this better? Absolutely, it would make it a ton better, yes. Yeah, because if we change the order of the loops, now we access, there's nothing in between accessing A0 and A1. Everything is great. Okay, any more questions on this? I'd like to try to get to other topics before going back to former cache miscounting questions, since I hopefully went over sort of a pretty general strategy, and we also have 25 minutes. And I think I should review cache blocking, probably. So before I move on, any other questions on sort of cache missing counting stuff? Yeah?
What is the LON 158 supposed to say? I know you were trying to link order
them. The what 158?
LON 158.
Oh, right. There are line numbers. A0 and A512,
the one below
it?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, this is, put this in parentheses. So A0 and A512 map to the same set. Also A1024 and A1034 plus 512 would map to that same set, but A is not that big. Yeah. So the question is, the other quiz question, that's reasonable. So in the other quiz question, the other quiz question had this code. And you might note that if you think about this, this is same as if we flip the loop order, as if we did up here this, but swapped I and J. So it's exactly the same situation as swapping the loop order, because we access access A0, A1, A2, and so on. So nothing in between accesses to the same block to evict them. So we get full advantage of things being in the same block, and this is the exact same situation as what was asked earlier about flipping the loop order. If you look at that new loop order, the indices we compute are exactly the same sequence. Okay, other questions? Okay, so I'll do my brief cache blocking interlude, for which I prepared slides, which is why I was really surprised that no one asked about it. I was that sure. So I'm gonna go through sort of a brief review of what we had last time, try to like cover it in a slightly different way. So we're gonna do the matrix multiply examples with things that approach cache blocking to kind of review what was going on. For these examples, I'm going to assume 4 elements of the matrix per cache block, which will be important. So here is our general pattern. So our matrix multiply, you don't need to care about the math. All you need to care about is that it looks like this loop. We accumulate values in C in this pattern. And everything we're doing, like you can think of it as a mathematical transformation. You can also just think of it as a way of changing the order we do the statement in this loop, because it doesn't matter the order, because you can add to C in any order as long as you're doing all the additions you're supposed to do, as long as you're doing additions for every possible I, J, and K. And everything we talked about with cache blocking and loop reordering is just about changing the order you handle the I's, J's, and K's, or however many variables you have. So here, if we look at this inner loop I have highlighted, we access this part of C, this row of A, and this column of B. And we have one miss to get this part of C at most. So this might be really sort of less than or equal to one miss. And we have n over 4 misses to get this part of A. Why n over 4? Because if we look at our cache blocks, we're storing the rows together, so we're going to get, you know, multiple elements of A together, and we're accessing it in order. We don't have to worry about having that problem where, we were accessing all of the cache block, but we accessed different other things in between. That's not happening here, at least not in a way which seems like it should be a problem. Generally, for these analysis, when we talk about cache blocking, we kind of assume that conflicts, like things that happen to the same set, are mostly not a problem. Even though if you choose like the wrong end, maybe they could be. We're just going to ignore that to keep things simple. And for B, you can see we only use a little bit of our cache block. So we have n misses, and I can count this in the number of misses per iteration, which is what was on Daniel Graham's slides. So we have 0 per C, 1/4 for A, and 1 for B. And we can use that to calculate the number of total misses, which was the analysis we saw last time. And I do the same thing here, and I forgot to highlight that this is part of what we're counting here. So we're counting the stuff which happens in this loop, but here I've changed the order. So previously it was I, J, K, here it's K, I, J. So we access a row of C, a little bit of A, and a row of B, and that's what it looks like. We count the misses in the same way, we get 1/4 plus 1/4 for iteration. Because again, we have our cache blocks that line up. Okay. So questions so far. So for reviewing actual cache blocking, it's important that we get the loop order analysis kind of down, because it's what we're going to use later. Yeah?
Why are you multiplying by n squared loops?
that's the number of times we run the thing I have in red, or line around, n squared times. Make sense? Yeah. The total is n cubed because we have n times n iterations of this, of the green highlighted line. And I've given counts for the thing in red and the counts for the thing in green as per iteration. Yeah?
Can you explain how you get the graphs that is C
named? So how did I know we were accessing a row of C? Well, I say, okay, during this loop, we access all possible J's but one I. So I determines a row because it's times n, and all possible j's is all the way across that row. For a, we access all possible j's and one I and one k, so that's an I and a k, and j doesn't matter. So it's one thing, similar for b. Make sense? That's how I figure, that's how I figured out what the shape of the thing we're accessing. Yeah. So the shape of the thing we're accessing here is I just say, what's J is changing, what is sweeping J across the matrix do here? I'm changing the column number, because I assume that times n is the row, so it sweeps across a column, same thing with B. Here, I'm changing nothing, so it's just one little piece of A. Okay, so I'm gonna try to do a little incremental step towards cache blocking, and that's gonna be that I'm gonna split up our loop in k, so I'm going to iterate through every other k with the k variable and use this double k variable with a corrected code, so that is a k, and this should be k plus 2. So I hope that makes it, so k equals k, so I'm taking just taking a range of, you know, two values, k and k plus 1. And I guess I made that mistake because I prepared these slides hastily this morning, which I will correct when I post them. So here, now I am accessing the same part of C in the green highlighted part. I'm accessing a little bigger chunk of A, and I'm accessing a little wider chunk of B. And if we do the calculations we did before, this becomes a little better because I am getting more reuse out of my values in C and my values in B. Or mostly my values in C I'm getting more reuse out of, and I'm getting more reuse out of my values in K. So I'm using two values from K, and I'm using applying them to all the same values in C, so I'm like doing twice as much work for each value of C. I'm reading in a block of A and using not just one element of it, but two. So this is better. So this makes sense. And one way of looking at this is I've improved my spatial locality in A. Previously, I was accessing completely different parts of A, you know, in the inner loop. Now I'm accessing two related parts of A in the inner loop. And in doing that, I've hurt my spatial locality in B, but not too much. I'm only accessing two rows. Yes?
Why do you disregard the n squared divided by 2 for the total
distance? Why is this n squared divided by 2? Because this is k plus equals 2, because I have this. So the green part runs n squared over 2 times.
Like, where did it go? Like, those three things added together?
I may have done the math. Where did the what go? The that's why this isn't approximately equals. I'm just assuming n is big enough that I don't care about n squared versus n cubed. Yeah.
How do you define what's in the green part?
How do I define? What do you mean define?
Like, how do you determine?
What? I just chose this arbitrarily to make the analysis easy. That I know how to count the misses in this part, assuming reasonably that like we don't have things in there before, and that's what I'm doing. I just chose a part to do that, and this is all an approximation because you notice I'm like not taking into account like do things map to the same set. I'm not doing a precise computation. This is all approximate numbers of misses. Yeah. why this be wider than C? Because in this loop, we have k, k equals k plus k and k plus 1, and that determines the row of B, so I have two rows of B that I'm accessing. But for C, I don't use k, k at all, so I have one row. It's determined by I, which stays the same throughout the entire green part. That makes sense? So I just did this with plus equals 2. I can change that plus equals 2 and make the same corrections I should have made here and do this k, k plus b. And instead of doing it over 2, I can do this over, you know, here, this would be b, and this would be b. So I can just generalize it to change the 2 to a parameter b that I can make bigger. And do the same analysis, but instead of having 2 in a bunch of places, I have things over b or times b and so on. Does that make sense? And no? Okay. Questions then? Yeah.
Is b referring to the matrix b, or is that?
Oh, right. Okay. That was something I should have thought of when making this slide. So we'll call this the block size. I probably should like, yes. So this is over B over the block size. And that, assume that everywhere, I will have to figure out another variable to use because I should have thought, oh gosh, I'm using B, yeah, okay. But the B that's used as a number is not the matrix B. Sorry for being confusing about that, yes. So why did misses occur in the first place? Which, what, where, then? The misses are, our assumption is that n is really big, so it's so big that because we're accessing other parts of the matrices, that we're gonna go through enough stuff that by the time we get anywhere in the matrices that we don't have anything relevant in there, just to simplify our analysis. Obviously, we might get lucky and maybe part of it was cached still for some reason. Is that, kind of, okay. Sorry?
I think I sort of get it.
Okay. So I'm just parameterizing the calculation in terms of changing 2 to a variable. And we can get more benefit, it turns out, by making that bigger, assuming we don't make it so big that this approximation stops working. So if B is, you know, if our block here is too big, then that's going to imply that we can't fit this little chunk here in cache. And that would make this analysis be wrong. Because kind of an assumption there is that that little chunk that I'm drawing fits in the cache. Otherwise, when we go back to the top, we'd have to load things again and we wouldn't have bn over 4, we'd have bn misses. And there's other things which might break down in a similar way. Like, you know, if we evict between elements here, if we have to load it multiple times because we have conflicts, that would be a problem too. So our general version is that we're going to do the same thing I did for k, and I'm going to do it for every other variable. And so the end result is I have this inner loop where I again need to correct my indices. So here this is k, k plus b, I plus b and I, and so on. This is j, j plus b, and again, b should be a separate variable. I will try to correct it to like blk when I post the slides. But the idea is that we're processing this section of b, so here we have I and I plus the block and J plus the block and something similar for A and B. And the hope is we have to access everything in here. So we have to bring in B squared things and we have spatial locality because we have most of the time our cache blocks overlap in a way where we use most of the cache blocks when bringing in this square chunk of A, B, and C. That we confusingly call blocks. I'll use the word matrix block to distinguish. So when we bring in that matrix block, it's composed of cache blocks, and we use most of all the cache blocks. Not all of it, but most of it. So we have b squared elements, 4 per cache block about, so b squared over 4 misses for this green highlighted segment of code. And this segment of code is going to run b over n cubed times. So we get, you know, this factor of b squared when we compute the total number of misses. And the idea is we make b as big as possible to make the analysis not break. And where the analysis breaks is that this assumes b squared plus b squared plus b squared elements fit in cache. If not, then I miscounted the misses. I'm assuming, to count all these misses, that we access everything in the block once, and we don't have to worry about like things being taken out of the cache in between accesses. And that's going to break down if the cache is bigger than that. Yes? That is quite possibly right. Did I b squared over? I also forgot a factor of 4. That was good of me. But I think so, something like that. The exact number is not the important thing. The important thing is that we have this large factor of avoided cache misses. So that's my review of cache blocking. So the big caveats is that we have this, we bring in these matrix blocks of the whatever things we're accessing, and they have to fit in cache. And that was because my miscalculation was assuming only compulsory misses, and that I got full advantage of spatial locality, that, you know, I not only had the compulsory misses, I never, you know, if I were accessing different parts of the same block, I'd only run the block once. That's not going to happen anymore. If it gets too big for the cache, we're going to have something else going on with conflict misses or capacity misses, and/or capacity misses. Also, I really ignore conflict misses. I never check to see, did things map to the same set? If you remember the example of what we went over from the quiz, we had like the indices just happened to work out really badly. I'm kind of assuming that isn't happening, and that my entire analysis did that. And that's generally what we've been doing, we'll do. But in practice, yes, it sometimes matters. It particularly matters when you're dealing with sizes close to powers of 2. But we just neglected that issue of conflict misses just because the analysis was already confusing enough without dealing with it. And with apologies for hastily putting together slides and not having a few notation issues. So questions on cache blocking? Okay, so let's go back to my list of text topics. So function inlining. Yeah, sorry. What? Yes. So function inlining is copy the contents of a function in place of a function call. That's what function inlining is. The compiler will do it if the function is small enough, and the compiler doesn't need to look across .o files. It might do it in some other circumstances too, but these are the big ones where the compiler might do it. If it's small enough and doesn't look across .o files, why small enough? Because if we did this all the time, like your program becomes really huge,
and that ends up being, you know, not only taking up more space on disk, but being slower. The compiler doesn't want to do that to you. And the compiler doesn't look across .o files, because the idea is you change the source file for .o file, you recompile it, you relink, you have the new version of the function. In order to make that work, it's hard to inline across .o files. Yeah?
Is inlining, like, when it makes the conversion handle, like, global variables?
So the question is, does inlining handle global variables and side effects? Yes, we just copy the contents of the function with variables, like arguments renamed as appropriate, and adding temporaries, but it's the same as if you mechanically copied it, handling all the details of, you know, dealing with scope of variables and so on. So there's no change in, there's no worry that inlining is going to change the semantics of the program. Like, it's going to be done, so you get the same answer. Okay. Other questions on inlining? Okay. And someone asked earlier about locality, spatial, and temporal. So spatial locality is nearby values. So caches, advantage of this with cache blocks being larger than in one value. So we can bring in multiple values at once. Temporal locality is repeated access to same value. Caches take advantage of this by adding things to the cache when they are accessed and trying to keep them if they've been recently accessed. Anything else in my last minute here to talk about? Yes? Where temporal locality is decreased? Sure. So if we... So just accessing things less time. So something like... This has more temporal locality than if I just say change this to 10. Right. We have less repeated accesses. Like that we just accessed some index in A is less of an indication than it was that we'll access it again. Whereas in the previous example, we're like 99 times out of 100 we'll access it again right away. Okay, so that's what I have. I will try to fix up my slides a bit and also post recordings of everything, drawings, and text documents.